dot, dot, dot. Woo!
Look at this, folks. It's a video. It's the very first video version of Weiss World. For those of you listening in audio land, as well as those of you seeing this video that you can find on my Facebook, Instagram, and where it lives on YouTube, my YouTube channel. Welcome to another adventure here in Weiss World, where nothing can go wrong. Yes, so welcome aboard, man. Today, it's always fun here at Weiss World, and for those of you on the video, look back here. There's Weiss World itself. That's my boy James T. with a red cowboy hat that my buddy Don Deal put on him decades ago. All kinds of stuff, little totems, things here in Weiss World that help make the magic happen, man. Welcome aboard. But it's an exciting day because my buddy, my pal, one of my favorite people in all the world, Nick Lane, is here today. Nick is, man, he's the king of the pop and rock horn sections. A great writer, arranger, composer. I first knew about Nick with Maynard Ferguson. I came on the band. There was one or two guys before me and after Nick, but he was the writer, one of the great writers for the band, and spectacular trombonist. Then he went on to play and perform with all kinds of folks. Rod Stewart, famously for quite a while, as well as Gino Vannelli, countless others, but we're going to talk about all that, and don't just take my word for it. Let's go talk to Nick right now. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Nick Lane.
Hey, folks, look, it's Nick Lane. He's here. What?
Hooray!
Wow. Oh, man, listen to that audience. You know,
the crowd response.
Oh, it's incredible. I didn't know there were that many fans of composing, arranging, and trombone playing. You know, it's
very validating, this is.
Oh, there you go. Well, okay, thank you. Can we get security down to the front? Security, please. Where's the Hell's Angels when you need them? Okay. All right, now they're quiet. Nick, how you doing?
Good, Steve. How about you?
Oh, man. Well, you know, hey, I got a full cup of Joe. And you know what? This is...
I'll join you.
Oh, look at that. You got the... All right. Here's to you, lad. You know, if you're ever in the Chicago area, we got to hook up. And as I mentioned in the email, the first five pints are on me.
And definitely. And I'll take you up.
We'll take it from there. Okay. There's a lovely Irish pub in the neighborhood here. It's staggering distance from the house. It's right
Andy,
right
for you.
Yeah, it's, yeah, right. Anyway, so yeah, full cup of Joe. I'm hanging with my pal Nick. We've known each other in the periphery. I mean, we remember when we first met, we worked together on that Storm album back in the day. That was, what was that? Admiral's Horn and Hitting the Head. You had a bunch of charts on that one.
Well, I brought in a song called Blasters that seemed, I thought, was perfect for Maynard's band, since the trumpet players by that time had lost all sensitivity. And he wanted to rename it. And because he was so famous for coming up with some of the worst titles possible, he wanted to name it The Admiral's Horn. And it was really about blasting trumpets. But called it. And I acquiesced because I didn't really care. But still, looking back on it, it's still a really stupid title.
Well, I can't tell you how validating it is to know that you did not write that title. That changes everything for me.
Well, I think I had given it out to other bands under the title of Blasters, it's gone back. And I used it in my own band. And Blasters is appropriate for a song with a featuring the trumpet section.
Oh, of course. It's, you know, it can't be argued. It's not wrong. when you think of those guys. You know, I often compare the personality of trombones and trumpets, and you know, the trombones are just happy to be anywhere. We're just like, man, life is great. Thanks for inviting me, man. Life is great. Trumpets, you know, 5 minutes in, there's a fight somewhere. It's like somebody's fighting. It's, I don't know, it's like a pub brawl or something. You get trumpets.
Oh, that's a good analogy. On sessions, you know, it's a fight for the trumpets. It's a fight to play lead. And on the trombones, it's a fight to play third.
That is the ultimate hang. Third trombone, man. That's, talk about a chill party.
Yeah, everybody heads right for the third trombone. Trombones do. I'm sorry. The trumpets. Yeah,
right.
They're fighting it. Yeah, they're fighting it off so you can play the highest.
See, that's why we live so long, man. Beautiful lives. We, you know, we look great. Look at you. You look like you're 20.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, bless you. So anyway, all right, we got a show here, I guess. This is the first video show. So, you know, it's, all the rest have just been audio. So I'm going to have to, if we share the screen or do anything fun, I'm going to have to comment for our poor non-video listeners who just, they are using the theater of the mind.
They're only seeing half the show, aren't they?
They are, man. If they could see it. So, for instance, we look back into the world of Nick Lane. You got like a hip, what is that, vintage? I'm looking at the tuner up there. It's got like, what has it got, man? A cartridge area for everything.
Oh, yeah. I have some gear up here that I can't get rid of. And so it it starts to look like art at some point.
It does. It does. That's like the Hans Zimmer studio with a wall that's just a Moog synthesizer. It's so cool. I've never been in it. I've seen videos. You ever worked with Hans? I'm getting off topic now.
Yeah. No, I mean, he does a lot of sessions, a lot of movies. I can't say that I have a personal relationship with him, but I have worked on things that he's done. Yeah.
He's just, my hero, man. Have you seen his live show? That is unbelievable.
No, I have not.
It's very cool. There's a lighting guy here from Chicago that does it. I'll send you a link. It's unbelievable.
Well, Bruce Fowler worked with Hans for years, and
he did.
Used to talk him into doing fairly adventurous things. And I think for that movie Inception, we did something with like 30 trombones or something.
I love that's one of my favorite soundtracks.
And you know, Bruce is such a wildly creative guy that it always reflected well on Hans that he would have Bruce in his midst, because Bruce is truly one of a kind.
Absolutely, man. What a family, and him, what a trombonist back in the day. And now he's Mr. Film doing everything, I guess, huh?
Yeah. I mean, he certainly has. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, hey, it's the Nick Lane Show. So we're going to start with that. Little bit like the Actor's Studio. I don't have blue cards, but I've got like these notes here. Look at that for folks on the video. Look, I got a whole, it's the Book of Nick right here.
Preparation is everything.
It is. You know, on my list of priorities, A, B, C, D, that comes in at H, but that's a whole, whole nother story. All right then. Hey, you know what? Nick Lane begins in Marshalltown, Iowa. That's where he begins. And so I'd like to know, musical family, what were the early sounds and influences of Nick Lane there in the heartland?
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's it's a fairly, I guess it was musical, but not in a professional way.
And, right. Well, was it around the house? What kind of things were you listening to?
Yeah, my mom and dad met playing flute in the Methodist Church Orchestra. I think dad only took up the flute just because he saw there was a cute flute player in the orchestra. So I think he hearkened back to his high school days when he used to play flute and found a way to sit next to her. And
that's what music's all about, right there. That's,
and my dad could fake pretty well on the piano. He was he was pretty good in the key of C.
Oh.
So yeah, it, so like no, keys. but. We did not have we did not have a lot of music in our family. We certainly had a piano, and my older brother was skilled and gifted in those, in those areas. He could play. He was a good pianist, and he played trombone. So
Oh,
that's why
really?
I started on the euphonium, and in fact
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
carried it through, started Drake University majoring in
Right?
euphonium. So
Wow.
yeah, I was fairly clueless.
Perfect to eventually have a career as a trombonist. It's kind of a prerequisite for us. It's
Well, trombone was always kind of a, like a fallback position. It's
So it was.
I only
Go on.
switched from euphonium because for the money and the girls.
Folks, we've just started this show and already.
Sorry.
My man, no, that's the direction I hope to go. But wow. So what was high school like? It was euphonium. You were totally euphonium guy. Band
Yeah, I mean, I
program or
played in the
no?
jazz band. We were band geeks, there were a bunch of us, and
Yeah.
I had a little five horn band, and that we
Huh.
played Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears tunes, and I
Right.
was trying to write, but we didn't have any music classes or anything, so
Ah.
I had no idea what I was doing, and
Wow.
but we you know
Self-taught.
but we went we, yeah we went for it, and
Wow.
it was exciting.
I think that's one of the best ways to learn. I mean, because you're learning, you're going after it like, ooh, I like this, I want that. It's like, the Beatles traveling across town to find that chord that they heard from that jazz guy, and it's they want this stuff. That's the best way to learn, I think.
Oh, yeah,
Nobody
I think so too.
telling
And
you.
I went to
Yeah.
Drake University majoring in euphonium for a couple of years, and they kind of took me as I really wanted to play, but I didn't really know what that entailed, to be a professional musician. And there was a great trombone player in Des Moines named Steve Stewart that had said, you should go to where the musicians are if you want to play, and you should go to where the best teacher is, which is really good advice for anybody looking to
Absolutely.
a music career. So I transferred, went out to Boston, Berkeley, to
Yeah.
study with Phil Wilson. And
Oh, see, that
so
was I was
that's
going to ask you, who was your guy there? So trombone and composing and arranging, did you do that with Phil or
yeah,
who?
and really Phil had was starting to teach at New England Conservatory at that point. So I had studied with Tony Latta and Tom Plasek at Berkeley. But really, the
Wow.
guy who had the most influence, I think, if we're talking about, mentors, was a guy, Herb Pomeroy, was
Oh,
an
man.
arranging teacher, a brilliant musician and
Yep.
arranger and teacher. And
Wow.
I learned so much from him. And basically, he's one of those guys that gives you all these techniques. Duke Ellington was his thing.
Oh, man.
Analyzing all of that, understanding why Duke did the things he did, and what an amazing band that was. But then he's, once you leave, he goes, forget all the rules and do what you hear, do what you feel.
Oh man, what great advice. I notice with some students nowadays, not all of them, but occasionally I run into some folks that forget that first part. You got to learn all of the craft and then forget and listen and do your thing. But if you just start out with that, it's you got no language and
Yeah, we spent hours writing out scales for different chords in different contexts, what the where the tension was, and it seemed really menial and stupid at the time, but it's
Right.
that hammering the basics into you about when you see a chord and you hear it and you know where the tension is, where the pot what the potentials are.
Oh man, what a great education. And so many great musicians talk about going where the musicians are. That crowd at Berkeley, thousands of incredible musicians from all walks
Well,
of life.
and when I got there, I don't know if this was the same for you. When I went to Drake University and playing euphonium, I didn't have exposure to jazz really, and Maynard's band played our jazz festival in my first year. So he in
Wow.
'73, I'd never heard of Maynard when he had brought the
Wow.
band there in '73, and of course
Yeah.
I was blown away, But I, you know, and Thad Jones and Mel Lewis, you know, Thad Jones was kind of the guy as far as the big band thing. But when I went out to Boston, I never heard of Charlie Parker. Or I didn't know Miles Davis. I hadn't listened to John Coltrane. So I was playing catch up. I felt like, oh, these guys know this whole language that I don't. And
I'm right with you, man. Same thing with me. Yeah, I came up. Yeah, kind of through rock and through Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and everything that was on the radio in the 70s. And then from those guys, oh, who's this JJ? What? Oh, Charlie, who? And then, you start expanding. But it's kind of cool to come from the rock and pop environment to jazz. I think that's kind of hip, too.
Well, and it seemed like ignorance. I was leading with ignorance throughout my my career, if you can call it that.
That you know, might be a memoir title right there. I don't know. Leading with ignorance. The Nick Lane story.
Yeah, at least naivete, you know, that you just you weren't aware of all the things. You know, when I got on Maynard's band, they were listening to Weather Report and Earth, Wind, and Fire. And, you know, it was like, that was all new stuff to me as well.
That's exciting.
But I didn't know that. I didn't know about. And of course, then when I got the Rod Stewart gig, I had never heard of Rod Stewart, and I had no idea what rock and and he wanted to do, Otis Redding and Sam Cooke and Wilson Pickett, and I didn't know anything about those guys either.
Back in those days, you couldn't pick up your phone and like that. You had to do some research,
And so I was turned on to all this stuff that I loved, and yet it was this newness thing that it just seemed like everywhere you turn, there's something else really cool. And I think it's still that way. I don't know about you. It's a lot of things sound like something that's already happened.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of neo out there. You know, I noticed it's hard to find something absolutely new, like say Jacob Collier or something that's like a, woof, this is a new spin. A lot of it comes, they say, who is they? I don't know. I read an article somewhere that the most popular music of today is the music of the 1970s. So the most listened to and the most imitated, which is cool because that was a great era. But that's interesting. I ran into this group called Sungazer. I don't know if you've heard of them. I had no idea. Adam Neely and Sean Crowder. Unbelievable, funky, crazy, odd meter, kind of modern sounding thing. But you can hear clearly their roots. You can hear that it's neo 70s once again. But
I'll have to check that out. Yeah, it seems like I'm always, especially with the YouTube and the proliferation of free music, there's so much going on and it's hard to take it all in. I only recently came across Snarky Puppy, which I guess has been around for a decade or two. And boy, they did some great stuff. Were you at North Texas when they were there? Was that?
Yes. Or are they kind of? That was right before they hit. When I went to get my my master's, I don't think they were doing it then. But then when I came back and directed the 1 o'clock for a while, that was right before they hit it big. So I had this wonderful student, Sarah Giacovino, a great, great trombonist and writer. And she brought in this thing she was working on, had this cool groove I'd never heard. I said, man, what kind of groove is that? She goes, it's a Snarky Puppy thing. I said, it's a what? And first I'd heard of them, and she was playing in the group at that time, and they were pretty much just in the DFW area. But then, they hit it big, and they are happening now.
Some great players, and I guess that's the bottom line. I think when I was coming up, and maybe you were right on the tail end of that too, or it was a binary choice. You either went to New York or you went to LA.
Sure.
And now it seems like there are great musicians everywhere.
It is. Yeah. I think, this thing we're on right now, the hooking into the internet and everything has really shrunk the world and evened out the playing field and opened the doors for everybody. It's The best of times and worst of times in many ways. But the best of times is that I'm here with Nick Lane, so I'll keep going. Okay, so after Berkeley, at some point you join Maynard's band, and 4 years or so. What an unbelievable group you joined too. Was that? Tell me some of the guys that were in there, and tell us about this Maynard thing.
Well, the advice of going where the musicians were was good advice, and I had met a trombone player named Roger Homefield, who got on Maynard's band, and then there was a guy Randy Purcell that had been on Maynard's band for years, and Randy was retiring and taking a gig in Pittsburgh, and so they needed a trombone, and Roger got me on, and so that was my introduction onto the band. And yeah, it was a killer band.
Wasn't Erskine on there and stuff? And
yeah, Peter was playing, and Gordy Johnson, and you know, some of my good pals, Joe Mazzello and on trumpet, and Mike Migliore, Bobby Militello on saxophones. They were Eric Trauben and I started at the same time. So
really,
so. That's right. You worked with some of these guys too. So
yeah, with Eric, I did. They were calling him Zembo Mosque at that time. That was his
you know that name. Was our very first gig in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Zembo Mosque in Harrisburg, and you know we had like a afternoon rehearsal, and then because they had just come back from Europe, and so they'd been out. Eric and I joined the band, and the first gig was the Zembo Mosque, and the name stuck. And for the entire time, Eric was Zembo.
You know, I never called him Eric. I knew that was his name, but it was Zembo. And man, two or three cartoon characters I've devised that stand like him. He had that Leaning Tower of Pisa thing, you know, that he did when he didn't stand like a human. He was always Zembo. I hadn't thought about him in a while.
He was a great player, and I think in a way kind of unheralded. He was not not a self-promoting kind of personality,
right?
And so he was very much a meat and potatoes. Played time and played great ideas and great changes. He loved to quote classic jazz things, and he was great.
I loved him, man. What a great cat. As an aside, that your band early on was the first Maynard band that I saw live. You know, I'd been following him on the record since my band director introduced me. I'd never heard of him either. And then my band director said, typical Southern approach, he goes, "Son, you ever heard this Maynard Ferguson fella? I think you'd like him." And put on something, I forget what it was, and life-changing moment. So I went to see him, and there you were. I don't know. Oh, what year would that have been? Like 70? I don't know, but it must have been late 70s.
77 was when I joined. And
I bet it was 77 or 78. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was this thing. What's that?
No, it was a great band. Yeah.
Oh, man, just killing. And I remember listening, you know, just being blown away by everything. But then you came out and did a wonderful solo. And ended it on a double B flat. And I thought, well, listen there. That's a nice thing. I like that.
I would deny that. I can't imagine that happening.
I was there. I'm a witness. It happened, folks. It really did. What a great band. All right. Look at this. I got my notes. I got to keep going. Post Maynard. This is like the Actor's Studio. Questions now from the audience? No. Post Maynard, back to L.A., or you moved to L.A. at that point? How did that work?
Yeah, I moved to L.A. I tried to give Maynard notice that I was going to leave in the end of 1980. Yeah. And of course, then he just used it to needle me for the rest of the 2 months I was out on tour with him. I shouldn't have mentioned it, you know, but
yep.
And at that time, Bobby Shue was a trumpet player in L.A., and I met him he came to one of the Maynard's gigs, and of course Maynard was saying I was moving to LA. So he goes, gives me his number, and he goes, call me when you get to town. So wow. In January of 81, when I came to LA, I call him, and he goes, you know, the musicians had been on strike. There was a strike. Everybody, the directors, actors, everybody went on strike when there was the proliferation of cable TV. And everybody settled except the musicians. And so there was it was a dark time. And Bobby was saying, when I called him, I said, yeah, I just got to town. He goes, well, the music business is over. I'm going to just play jazz and do clinics and concerts. Wow. I'm not even going to bother with sessions anymore. And he was a pretty busy guy at that point.
I'll bet.
And that
yeah.
was disheartening.
Yes.
To say the least.
Career, it's over.
Yeah. And to his credit, that's really what he did. He did concerts and clinics and did them really well. You know, that when I hear people say, oh, the music business is over, I always think back to 1981 when Bobby told me that, and it was like, not so much.
Not really. No, it's we're always told that. Many times we feel that, but life finds a way. You know, we keep it going somehow. It's challenging nowadays with music being free. Not the best business model, but
no, and the idea of trying to monetize music. Is, you know, I have not figured that out, and I guess I don't really want to, but you seem to be stepping out there and taking technology where it needs to go. So
I'm working on that. It seems to me to be, I've got some friends and mentors that consider technology as a tool. If you learn how to use the tool correctly,
right.
You know, as opposed to being scared of it or upset at it. And, AI falls into that category too. So, if we can leverage it, you know, and use it like any other tool, it's like, it's a spatula for serving music somehow, you know.
Nice.
Boom. Thank you. Well, you're in LA, and then at some point you hook up with Rod Stewart and you start in LA, you started the Bone in the USA thing first, right? Was that before you hit the road?
Yeah, I didn't really know anybody in L.A. Everybody from Maynard's band had gone to New York. And I kind of wanted to go to New York, too, except that I saw the conditions they were living in. And in New York, like Broadway is a great gig, you know, Broadway show. And I didn't have any aspirations to play Broadway. So I headed to L.A. and didn't really know anybody, and you know, did some rehearsal bands, you know, you do the usual thing, but I put a band together because I had written a lot of charts, you know, so I put a nine horn funk band together and called guys up to invite them to play with me, and so that was, and then that led to an ill-fated album. It was before CDs. And,
it's a great album. It's going to be on the lightning round, so watch out.
Oh. Yeah, right. I did a radio show with Jeff Babko just recently, celebrating its 40th anniversary. So,
wow, that's incredible. Yeah, that's scary.
Well, 40. So that was at the time we were going for it, even though we didn't know what it was.
Right.
And I think that put me out there. You know, I was not interested in playing swing, and I was doing some big band stuff with Matt Cat and Goob, had a great band at that time.
Sure.
So I was doing some of that, but I really was looking for something more contemporary. And Paul Anka had a new album out and put a band together out of L.A. And I was part of that. And Michelle Colombier was the musical director and arranger. And that was a good experience for about 6-8 months, and then from that the Rod Stewart gig came out of nowhere.
Wonderful.
That was a fluke. Everything was kind of a fluke, and as I say, once again, I had no idea what I was getting into, but it was fun.
Oh man, I look at it as leading a charmed life. You are.
Well, and that's one of my fallback positions. It's better to be lucky than good. So,
you know, and then see, and I'm not pandering to the guest here. When you're lucky and good, ta-da, And that's the Nick Lane story right there.
Well, yeah. What's the old cliche about, opportunity is the combination of what, preparation or something. And,
right.
You know,
yep.
Or, you know, so you have to be ready when, because the door is going to open at some point.
Right. Absolutely. And you have to have the goods when it does and be ready, and you have to actually go for it. And something like Bone in the USA, making a scene, inviting the cats, which, by the way, that's one of the great titles. See, if Maynard would just listen to you, he would have had some great titles.
If only. Bone,
if only. Oh, man. So then, oh, you know what? Before we get past the Rod Stewart thing, I have a shout out, a hello from one of your old buddies, Mr. Chick. Michael Chickowitz says hello.
He was
with you. Yeah. Well, he said you could tell some stories about him that we would not be able to publish, but
he's a bit of a, you know, this is what they call legends, you know, as you get older.
Yeah,
you know, this would be the legend, right, of Mike Chickowitz, really.
Right. And I, you know, I've known him in the periphery for a while, but then last night, you know, he's got this band, Tributeosaurus, that is, that does these amazing tribute concerts, and last night we had a 3-hour rehearsal doing Chicago, and which will lead me to another point, is that with you being Jimmy's sub, great googly moogly, the face it requires and the air it requires to play more than one of those tunes back to back is that'll change your life right there. It's like, wait a minute, I thought I was in shape, man.
Exactly. I did 3 weeks in Mexico. I just got back last week, and was fun to do. We did 8 shows. It was fun to do that many shows. Usually if I just go out and fill in for a weekend or something, you know, you hit the ground running. The guys have been out for a while, and it's hard to just drop in. It's a lot of playing. You know, Jimmy has created a gig. It's, in a lot of ways, it's very intelligently written. It's not all high stuff.
Right.
But it's a lot of, a lot of metal against flesh. And metal always wins that battle.
It does every time. Because when it climbs up, you know, you're staying in the D's and C's range when it goes up there. And then, you know, thankfully it does go lower, but. So, all right, this is earlier than I was going to ask, but let's deal with this 20-plus careers. You've been associated with the band longer than Terry Kath did at the beginning, really, if you think of it that way.
Wow.
You know, if you think of it that way, but...
Well, but it's not even my gig. That's the greatest thing about it. Is that...
Right. You go out, you go home, you go out, you get to go home. That must be incredible. And of course, we have a friend in common with Ray Herman. You know, he and I went to school at North Texas together, and he's just been my brother for so long. That must just be a blast. But here's a question for you. How long did it take you to memorize that book? I mean, damn. Was that quick?
Yeah,
are you a good memorizer?
Yeah. It's interesting. I had done the Chicago gig with Earth, Wind, and Fire when they first went out back in 2007 or something. And memorizing those songs is hard because the chord changes are the same. The horn licks change, but, you know, it's like you have to memorize what horn lick comes next. Whereas the Chicago stuff, the horns are sort of an integral part of the song. Yep.
Right.
So I thought it was easier memorizing the Chicago stuff because it was, you know, you're playing, you know, the chorus, whatever, the opening of, does anybody know what time it is? Bum, 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 bum. You know, that doesn't ever happen again. So you zero in on stuff as opposed to trying to remember which lick goes over the same 4 chord changes.
Right. That must be tough. Oy. Did another thing I've wondered just watching from the audience is that did you have to have a choreography discussion? I mean, running all over the stage. When are you here? When are you there? Or you just pick it up?
The first time that I watched the band, I memorized this stuff. And I had done like a 45-minute corporate set in Palm Springs when I first filled in. And so it was just a few songs, you know. So, and then by the time I flew out to Caesars in Atlantic City and I watched one show and then dropped in. And, you know, Jimmy is such a personality on stage.
Amazing.
And he has, you know, he has a thing, a joie de vivre that I, you know, it's like, I learned the notes, but I can't do all those moves. So I left that to him. But, and as a player, you would know this too. He's never had to compromise. You know, he never had to, well, I mean, maybe early on he had to play "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You," you know, like we had to. But, you know, playing in an orchestra, he can do all that stuff. But for his whole career, basically, he's played it the way he heard it.
Isn't that
amazing?
They
kind of followed him. You know, Lee and Walt are such great musicians, too. But I think they followed him for the phrasing. And so it's very, I mean, obviously, it's very bonistic, you know.
It is.
But
That's the beauty
he plays of it. In a way that is hard to emulate. Because he has evolved individually from the realities that we have confronted as studio, you know, sausages, willing to do whatever it took. Jimmy's had a pretty strong idea of what it ought to be, and it's great. It's a great gig.
Instantly recognizable style and sound is not many folks that are that individual. Listen, Jimmy's in the background. You can hear him. You know, it's
when he complains to me about how hard the gig is, I kind of say, you know, I know, but I'm not sympathetic because you have nobody to blame but yourself.
That's right. You did it, man. That's great. That is excellent. Oh, man. Okay. Well, where were we? More personal stuff here. I got to ask you. How was it to work? One of my heroes musically was and is Gino Vannelli. The first thing that I arranged for Maynard way back in the day, right after you left, about a year later, I came on. And one of the first charts I did was Brother to Brother and wrote it up for the band. It was never recorded, but I thought they sounded great on it. So I've always loved him. How was it? You've recorded a live thing with him and went on the road. How was that? Is he a personable cat or what was that like?
Well, he's he seems like a really great guy. I wasn't there long enough to really know, but certainly the music, the legacy of his music and his brothers were still involved. You know, it was a musical intelligence that they transmitted into popular music that was very cool. What was that? Like the 80s, was that late 70s or was that 80, early 80s?
Late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, because I was listening to it when I was out with Maynard. So
that stuff was cutting edge harmonically.
Yeah.
Very cool stuff. And he still sings great, you know. And, you know, he had that very, very narrow mustache. And I'm always a little intimidated by that.
It is a scary look. Yeah.
What is that? Like a pencil mustache or something?
Yeah. You have to have an unbelievably serious beard to pull that one off. my whole thing is like if you like brushed glue on my face and then if I stuck my head into a bowl of like fluffy down of some kind, that's my beard. It's just like this little light thing.
But it softens your hard edge.
Oh, thank you. That's nice to hear. That's better than what I usually say. It gives me a chin, but I like that better. It softens my hard edge. That's excellent. All right, I'm going to steal that. Hey, all right. Well, it's a trombone show, so at some point we got to do a little trombone. So here's some trombone questions for you. What is the Nick Lane setup? What's the equipment? I see something back there. What do we got? What's the preferred?
Yeah, it's a King. I still play a King 3B.
My man.
I bought it from Bob McChesney, 45 years ago. And every time I see him, he wants it back. So, but he's not getting it. It's still a great horn. I have several, but I play a Yamaha copy of an 88H for my brass quintet stuff. And
Oh,
I have
cool.
a Getson bass trombone that, makes me sound, I can play the notes, but I'm not sure that I
Right.
sound like a bass trombonist.
I
But,
wish I had
and
some of
I
that.
have always used a Bach 11C.
Wow.
So it's, but now I had some swelling a few years ago, and I now use a Doug Elliott mouthpiece with a Lexan plastic rim.
Oh, cool.
That I really like. I don't know what the number is on it, but it's one of those cup rim kind of combos that basically simulates probably an 11C.
Oh, right. Sure. Sounds like it's very comfortable to play that mouthpiece.
It is. For some reason, I had an allergy to gold. I really think it was.
Ah.
We were doing a brass band before U2 was going out on the road doing that Joshua
Wow.
Tree album.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a song where they used a British brass band, something about a mill company or something. Anyway,
yeah.
Bono couldn't sing it. It was in G, and Bono couldn't do it in G anymore. So they had to do it in F. So they
Yeah.
had to we had to redo the entire brass band.
Oh,
which,
man.
So I was playing euphonium and, tuba parts and French horn parts, just covering it, doubling, doing all these parts.
Yeah.
And my chops kind of swelled up and didn't unswell.
Oh.
And so I went to an allergist, and I thought it was the universe telling me I should give up.
Right,
but,
right.
But it wasn't. Or may have been.
Or become a Kardashian or something. If the lips swell
yeah,
up and up, it's a look.
I didn't take the hint. It felt like I had like one of those orangutan, those big red butts right there on the front of my face.
Woo!
It was not a good look.
Talk about an individual style. Oh yeah, man, I love that cat with the orangutan butt face. That's a
yeah
great...
butt face. Yeah. Anyway, I like the Lexan, the plastic rim, and it's and
yeah,
I have
yeah.
I have it for all my horns now. I have a 5G for the classical horn, and the 1.5 AL or whatever those things are, the big one for bass.
Well, if you take that beautiful equipment and everybody personalizes their thing, Ed, what would we find if we went into the Nick Lane shed on a daily basis? What's going on in the Nick Lane shed?
Well, as far as practicing,
yeah, daily regime practice.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say that I have not purchased the CD that Ralph Sauer did the duets. I think they were the Remington duets that he had recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So I do those long tone duets with Ralph because it reminds me of what a trombone is supposed to sound like.
Right. Oh,
and and then I've sequenced out a bunch of things. I just hit play, and the Irby Green method that he put together for an hour, I think it was an hour a day or something when he had a day off. These were the exercises he did. So it's a lot of tonguing and lip slurs and arpeggios and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I try to get through that. That takes me almost an hour to do.
Yeah.
As we were talking about the lunch with Charlie Loper earlier, a lot of times I ask the guys, the older guys, what it takes to keep their chops in shape,
right.
And they're basically saying, I hardly get around to practicing because my warm up routine ends up being, an hour long just to feel comfortable. And
that's interesting
sometimes
to hear. I find myself doing that too. It's, my wife can attest to that. She probably, I need to go hear you play because all I hear is the warm up. It's like all day long if I'm taking breaks. It's, but yeah, I find that too. It takes forever for maintenance to do it right.
Yeah, and I as much as that helps me, I never used to practice that much.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're the same way. When you're playing all the time, you don't have to practice. And I still haven't really locked in on what I can do at home that translates into a live gig situation.
Oh, it's almost impossible. I remember Doc Severinsen used to tell me that there's no way to practice the gig. You know, it's always so different no matter what you do in a practice. I mean, I felt that last night doing all those Chicago tunes. I'd worked on the notes. I tried to play everything like 10 times in a row to simulate. Nope. You get there on the gig and it's totally different.
Yeah, and you step out and there's an audience and suddenly
you
go into this overdrive. And I mean, it's fun when you're in shape to do that. I mean, it was the same on Maynard's band, don't you think, when you were playing? I mean,
Adrenaline City.
And they played at a volume level. When I first joined, I was not prepared to play as loud as everyone was playing around me. And
it was huge. It was like riding a lightning bolt to play with that band. And as you know, swapping fours with Maynard and stuff and standing next to him was, what is this?
Well, and when I was playing with him, you could probably relate to this too, that Maynard was not a practicer. You know, he was not at all. As opposed to a Doc Severinsen, since they were, you know, almost peers at that time or came up together in Charlie Barnett's band. Doc was always, meticulous in his approach and practice, and Maynard was sort of a physical freak that he could just blow through it, you know. And by the time, you know, I remember Maynard turned 50 when I was on the band, which I thought was really old. But
now that a thing, isn't it? Nowadays that seems pretty young.
but he doesn't practice, and so he would, you know, it'd take him a few days to blow himself into shape, and he would get there. But I became kind of aware that he wasn't really able to play technical things, maybe as I felt like he could have in the past. As far as just even holding a straight tone, he would go to that vibrato, and he would be doing the that kind of
snake
deal.
Snake thing, yeah.
Yeah, and I was not a fan of that as much, and just tried to get him to play straighter. And the whole concept of, you know, you got to have low notes so that the high notes sound high.
Right.
It has to, high is relative.
And he had such a great low register. I used to love when he would do that, like Christmas for Moderns or something, when he'd go way down low. It's just
He could do that. We did that thing with just an orchestra, an Offering of Love, I think, on the It's My Time
gorgeous.
Album,
yes.
where
gorgeous.
We all played live in this, you know, with the orchestra and the flutes and he played the flugelhorn, and it was magical. It was catching lightning in a bottle kind of thing. And
was that your arrangement? Who did that?
Yeah, that was it was an Indian, I guess it was a dedication to Sai Baba with his Offering of Love. Maynard always was wanting to do an Indian song. And so this was a bit of a compromise, but it was a regular song. You know,
it was beautiful.
Chord changes.
I don't know if you guys did it. This is where it came from. But when I first started, the show would, the crowd, the lights would go off and they would pipe that in, that recording, An Offering to Love. And that would happen right before we'd start with Blue Birdland. And I was blown away. I just thought that was the most beautiful thing. So I know what you're talking about.
And that was the flugelhorn, and that was Maynard playing in trying to keep him in a lower register. And his whole thing was always ballad playing. You know, he could interpret a melody. And he was so great at it, and a little theatrical, you know, that was definitely a performance aspect to it. But it became frustrating after a while with the whole high note thing is kind of a, I don't know what it is, like a bizarre, I guess as a trombone player or as trombonist, I don't want to drag you into this, but, you know, it's not quite our thing. And so you kind of look at it and go, what is that everybody goes crazy over these high notes?
Right. Yeah. Because when you do it on trombone, it sounds like a low trumpet. So people are like, next, this is not impressive. The trombonist might think it's impressive, but, you know.
It's yeah. funny, and there is a bunch of guys, and you are, you know, a very exciting kind of, you know, player. So I'm not taking anything away.
Thanks. Yeah,
but
yeah,
it is for some reason this the I don't know if it's a high note. It's like a fetish or something. These people they like should right. be wearing rubber suits and. And fuzzy outfits. It's like weird. You know?
That would fit in with many crowds these days. Hey, you know what? Speaking of funny stuff and fuzzy suits, we're running a little low on time. I don't want to take up your whole day. Well, I do want to take up your whole day, but I'm not going to take advantage of you. So there's two things left. One is the lightning round. And every time I say the word lightning, like right there, there's this incredible sound effect of lightning. So that'll be happening. I know, it's scary. Watch this. Lightning. Oh, what the heck was that? I'll put in a double one there for that. So before we do that, though, it's time for a word from our sponsor. And so you want to do a commercial? This is in no way does Nick Lane support this endeavor. But I want to yank him into it and hopefully get him involved one way or another. But here, okay, so I'm going to experiment now with this new software. Let me see if I can share my screen. That's the first thing. Okay, let's see what happens. What do we got? Holy mackerel, that looks scary. What is that?
It's you and me to infinity.
Whoa, to Nick Lane and beyond. Wow. Okay, I'm gonna stop that. That was scary. Let me try another one. That was kind of cool.
I'm in Weast World, am I not?
You are. You are in Weast World, but now I want to actually share the screen where I can see this thing, Jamtrek.
Yes, I see Jamtrek.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, so here's the commercial. This is an endeavor of mine. It's in the early days. It's a social media for creatives to share, advertise, and discuss. It's a community. It's for us. There's no algorithms, just a chill hang. It's Jamtrek, folks. And if you want to go there, it's jam-trek.com. It's free. The only commitment is just show up and have a good time. So forget about all those other social medias. This is the one for artists to come hang. And what's happening here, you might ask. So I'm going to give you the tour. There it is. The first thing you do is when you come to the page, it says how to set your stuff up. I mean, everybody knows how to do this, but it's similar. That logo, how about that, huh? It's UFOs.
Fabulous. I'm
totally into the space thing. Here's a guy put up a post about dinosaurs. Here's a chart I'm working on. Tunes. This guy did a thing with Jacob Collier. But then we get to the heart of the matter I wanted to share with you down here. Look at this guy. Here's our boss, Maynard Ferguson. Get the screen bigger. Look at that. The mouthpiece bandito himself, Maynard Ferguson.
The guy takes a good photo. What can we say?
He does. Look at all those mouthpieces. All right, so there's that typical aspect, but also you can make your own little page and stuff. So here's real quickly a couple of pages I did. One is AI comedy. I've found that with AI, artificial intelligence. Oh, and now for the folks that are not watching the video, we just showed a picture of Maynard Ferguson dressed up like a bandito of the old times, and instead of bullets across his vest, he had mouthpieces. But when you ask AI for stuff, especially trombone, like, give me a picture of a trombone. I said, aliens playing trombone. Look what it comes up with. I don't know what it is, but that's not a...
Yeah.
So I decided, let me just go ahead and embrace these AI pictures and make some comedy. So this is, look, Zorb, I have created a human trombone. Listen as I render bebop. Yeah, not so much bop. So created with AI. We're looking at the page now for our audio listeners. You got to go check out the video. Here's one of my favorites. So I made them like one panel, if you can see this. So AI comedy. Here's a picture. I said, give me a cow, a musicologist cow playing the cowbell. And this is what AI came up with. So I said, celebrated musicologist Dr. Bessie Phillips suddenly realized that she was trying to play her cowbell incorrectly. Also, what she was playing was not a cowbell. Also, she had human fingers. There you go.
Yeah, this AI thing is endlessly entertaining. It's amazing.
Oh, it is. It's so, look at this. I said, make a bass trombone. It came up with that. It's a bass. It's a trombone. Oy.
Yeah, I think there is a basic misunderstanding of the trombone, it appears, in AI.
It seems.
Maybe is a good thing.
I think so. Sometimes it's good to be obscure, and they're going to leave us alone, it seems. So there's a lot of pages. I got a whole thing that's just about my cartoons. And you can make your own page. It can be it could be like Nick Lane's charts. You ought to have one of these. Bob McChesney's on here, some other cats. Here's one of my, this is a thing, if Van Gogh was Van Gogh because he had cataracts. So that's the whole cartoon there, and he ends up with Starry Night because he's got cataracts. And here's this little cat.
Very clever stuff, Steve. Very clever.
Nice ear bandage, bro. Well, thank you, sir. All right, so that's that's Jam Trek. So, folks, ask for it by name, JAM-TREK, and we'll see you there. So that was our commercial. All right, now we have to end. But before we do, I'm going to just drop on you tunes, four of them, and then you get to comment.
Okay.
So I'll just mention a tune from your oeuvre. And I know, right? I had to practice that word for today. and
well
it's
done.
Right here. Look, here's the lightning round. It's right here. Let's begin the lightning round. Oh, that's very cool. It's worth having video just for that moment. All right, it's Born in the USA. Here we are. I chose Big and Hairy because, damn, that's so funky. Did you write that first off? It seems like, I bet you did. Big and Hairy.
I did. Yeah, that was the last thing that we did on that project. And by that time, that was the horn section that we had, that I was working with, Jimmy Zavala on sax and Lee Thornburg on trumpet. We did a track. With that horn section that we had done Rod Stewart and then Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So I included but I was experimenting with a drum machine in those days, and it
that's
has that
you on the drum machine. I thought it was drums, a guy playing it. So look at you. You can write drums.
Well, but
it's great.
And Luis Conte came in and played percussion on it.
Wow.
And interesting about this track is that he did a percussion solo, and then I wrote a horn solo to his percussion solo.
The
percussion solo came first, and then we played riffs to his percussion.
How cool. Well, that explains a lot of the personality in this track. We're gonna check it out right now. Now you know the story behind it, folks. Here is Born in the USA, the famous album celebrating over 40 years in the in the world. Here's Big and Hairy.
you. Cool. Okay. That's very cool.
Well, thank you, sir. The part of the whole idea of this podcast is to uplift cats, you know, and do what I can to help get people out there. And because we got to take care of each other, you know. Yeah.
Well.
All right. The next one here on the lightning round. I'm waiting for your look. You got to do the thing. Lightning.
Sorry.
See how spoiled I get. You're okay. Everybody's going to have to do that now. I'm going to say with the video, you got to pose for the lightning when that happens. This thing, oh my gosh, I love this. Personally, this is some of my favorite stuff. I've heard you do songs for the heartland. I chose Home on the Range. And first off, I got to ask, are you like a Vince Mendoza fan, or is it just naturally what you did? Because it reminds me a little of his writing.
His stuff
Yellow Jackets, you know.
Yeah, his stuff was so great. I had a buddy back in Iowa who was trying to resurrect Marshalltown, and there's a big town square and a courthouse, and so his concept was to do a music festival on the courthouse square in August. Sweet corn harvest time, you know. So it was supposed to be, you know, all things Midwest, all things Marshalltown, all things Central Iowa, whatever. So I was trying to write music. We had an orchestra, you know, and a chorus, and we did it for 7 summers to raise music raise money for scholarships to send a couple of local kids to Tanglewood Music Camp.
Oh, sure.
So the music was
alive at that point, I think, maybe. Was Bernstein
I'm not sure. Whatever. It was a fun project. I'm not that much of a salesman, so I feel like I may have dropped the ball in it becoming a great music festival. But it created some great music, and it was sure fun to do.
So I've got logistical questions and stuff. Now we know a little bit about the writing. So when did you start writing for orchestral settings? Was that just something you did initially or over the years?
I learned how to write for strings through Maynard. You know, that offering of love was with an orchestra. Right. We would do strings. We added strings on things. In the 70s, they were, putting strings were sweetening. So we would put strings on, on a Naima, a lot of those things. Kind of, I think Klaus Ogerman was probably my greatest inspiration for the use of strings in pop music. And that was an extension of commercial music with strings. Some of his stuff is breathtaking.
It really is. That's a good point, man. What were the logistics? So was this still a group of Iowa musicians, or you did this in LA when you recorded this thing?
Well, together. Yeah. So we would do it each summer. I started off with, the song of the Heartland, and with the choir and the orchestra. And then each summer I would write another piece. And so we ended up having this CD's worth of material. Tried to record it in Iowa, but the logistics were too difficult, and so could do it here in LA at the Eastwood stage at Warner Brothers and knock it out. So it fell a little short with having as much Iowa content as I was hoping. We used the choir from Iowa State University, but there's lots of Iowa folks on it, even folks from LA here who are from Iowa. So we tried to get the Midwestern thing going.
Absolutely. Well, let's hear some of it. It's Home on the Range is the one I chose. This is your own personal Aaron Copland, Nick Lane, writing about the heartland. Here's Home on the Range.
Thank you.
it is, and it is a ripoff of Aaron Copland. So, you know, what's the line?
You can't amateurs go wrong with borrow. That.
Yeah, amateurs borrow and professionals steal.
Ah, in that case, my friend, you and I are highly professional. I'll speak for myself. That's what I do when I write something. I go like, listen to everybody else. Ooh, I want that. I want that. I go grocery shopping. And yeah. Well, what a beautiful piece, man. And Aaron Copland, great googly moogly, that guy. I just love his music. But you know, let's dive into some jazz. We got two more things here on the lightning round. I don't even have to ask anymore, man. It's time for some Smith named Greg here, Smith and Lane project, and I chose Blues for Buddy, and we'll listen to that in a sec. Great solo by you, my friend. So was it your composition or Greg's? Who wrote this one?
Actually, that's Greg's. Greg spent some time after his Stan Kenton days. He spent some time with Buddy Rich, and Greg was fairly irascible. So he and Buddy kind of had a meeting of the minds. So he had done a blues tune that the whole concept of that band, it was Greg's concept to do a B3 trio, organ trio, with Barry and trombone. So we really had fun. Yeah, we had fun doing it, and the whole concept was to do it not rehearsed, just turn the recording on and play.
Wow.
And to catch that energy. You know, it's so often, I don't know about you, but here in LA, so often the best take is the first take.
Oh man, and almost always. Yep.
In a lot of cases, the engineers aren't quite ready, and so they all automatically say, "Let's do another one." And it's sort of that feeling of we keep doing it until, you know, it's like, "Well, let's play it till we get it wrong."
Well, you know, I've got a thing. I know which take it's going to be. Whichever take I didn't like my solo, boom, that's going to be the take every time.
Well, it's hard, and it's hard to get up. And I think that's one of the art of recording is to bring it every time. And
right.
I can't say that I have that, but I know others do.
Well, here in the land of jazz is Greg's composition, Blues for Buddy, from Smith and Lane, the wonderful organ. What would it be? A quartet, I guess. Trio.
No, organ trio, and it's a quintet, yeah. With
yeah, well, it's beautiful, and don't just take my word for it, folks. Here it is, Blues for Buddy. We'll be right back.
Oh,
there he is. He's still here, and yet we're still, ladies and gentlemen, in the lightning. He's giving up on it. You know, you don't want to overdo the shtick.
Oh, sorry. I was just imagining that the stillness that jazz can bring to a moment. You know,
contemplative. Yes, my wife Deborah and I were discussing this the other day. The CBS show Sunday Morning always ends one of their bits with a silence, and it's a variation of the sun. It's a picture of the sun, artwork, boom. And I always say that's the national moment. It's like you finish this beautiful bit, the sun comes up, and all over the land, people are going, It's like the reaction, well, it was funny when I mentioned it to Deborah, but you know... That's the beauty of this software. I'll put in some laughter smattering.
Okay.
Well, we got to end the lightning round with this. And that is, if anybody has a hit in the world of writing music, it's your rendition of the Joe Zawinul Birdland. So here's Maynard Ferguson land now, and your chart on Birdland. I think there's some stories involved with this chart. I don't know how many you can share, but what was this like? So you picked this out of the air. Erskine had not been with Weather Report yet. He was just a fan or something.
I was new on the band, and Maynard already had a writer who was doing all his writing, and so he wasn't looking for charts. And as you remember, we rehearse one day and then go out for 3 months. So the time to bring in charts was on that first day. And so I had brought a couple of charts in and nothing, of course. And so I brought in Birdland and we played it once. And, you know, the band basically kind of butchered it. It really wasn't a reading band. We never played it again. And it got back to me. The guys in the band wanted to play it, but Maynard didn't. And it got back to me that several years earlier, I guess, I never saw the article, I guess in Downbeat or something, they'd interviewed Joe Zawinul and Wayne Shorter, who I guess had briefly played with Maynard in the 60s and had disparaging things to say about him. Maynard had no interest in playing Joe Zawinul's song. And even when we played it and recorded it, it went over really well, and it was perfect for Maynard.
Absolutely.
And he deconstructed it, you know, he opened it up for a bass solo and, you know, what he usually does and takes it apart. It used to frustrate me when he would, you know, dissect the chart.
Well, yeah, come back later when they've been on tour and it's like, who wrote this? What? That's my chart. Wait.
Yeah, and then he goes, well, we're going to record it, and so we need it to be 4.5 minutes long. And it's like, well, now you've made it, turned it into a 15-minute odyssey, and now we got to cut it down to it was cut up in a way that I'm not that thrilled with. But when we did it live, you know, as much as it frustrated me in retrospect, the takeaway, what I learned was that is the essence of jazz, is to deconstruct something, to have it open, and to perfect. Open it up and explore something else. And the recorded version, I think, falls short of what we used to do live.
Oh, right. Well, we're going to play it anyway, but... But use your imagination, folks. What would this have sounded like live, opened up? And I've seen that and experienced it myself. I couldn't agree with you more. The essence of jazz is that aspect, you know. And that was what.
Unfortunately, this chart is not the essence of jazz. And Peter has told me since that Joe Zawinul didn't like it.
We're going to feature it.
So I guess my work is done.
Yeah, I guess. That's crazy. Well, okay, let me soothe you a little bit, is that it has become the gateway to Weather Report for many, many a young student. You know, they heard this first that led them to the ouvroir once again of Joe Zawinul. So that was a good thing. And it has become an absolute classic on the band. And as I sent you a little thing, everybody's tried to deconstruct your chart and use pieces of it. And they did that as they had a little hits medley, and it would always have to have parts of Birdland. And you know, and then
you did a great reconstruction of it. Way beyond anything I could have done. So it was
that. I just had fun with it, you know. But I remember, you know, Chris Braman, the trombonist, and I were the section for a long time after you had left, and we used to have competitions, see who could go the longest without chipping the A flat to start the melody. he would always win. I'd be like, "Squang da vidi da
da." Oh, and there was that little bop-a-lop in there.
Bop-a-lop, that's yeah. You got to get ready for that like 5 measures ahead of time. It's coming up.
We were young then. What can I say?
I know. At that point, we were mostly still cartilage. You know, we could do anything. But all right. Well, here's what we're talking about. This is Nick Lane's classic arrangement of the Joe Zawinul composition that Nick put together for Maynard. Here's one of the incarnations of Birdland. Boom, the kids go nuts. Oh.
Thank you, Steve.
We're back. Well, my pleasure. My goodness. And now comes the saddest part of the show where we have to wrap it up. I'm having too much fun. You got to come out. If I'm ever out in L.A., I'll give you a text or something and say, where
please,
are you at?
Please do.
And if you come out here, likewise, we'll hang deep dish and Guinness or something. I don't know. Whatever you're into. Well, maybe it's just coffee and a bagel, something. But
Good luck with Tributosaurus. Sounds like that'll be fun.
Oh, that's going to be a blast, man. You know, every trombonist on the planet, Jimmy is just their hero, myself included. So that stuff's, you know, it's just like the soul of trombone right there, I think, with Jimmy.
Yeah.
So that'll
really
be fun. And I'll tell Sir Chick that you said hello.
Yeah, give him my best.
Owit. I will. And he'll hear this, and he'll be very glad that we were gentle with his reputation and didn't tell all that story.
Yes, his legend is intact.
Oh, good, yes. Well, we don't want to, you know, there's the whole probation thing that he's on. We don't want to screw that up, you know, with the whole prison term and all that stuff. But, it has been a pleasure, my brother. Much love to you, and thanks for all the magic voodoo that you've been doing for a little while now, man. I appreciate
it. Great to hang with you, Steve, and thank you for letting me put my mug on your site.
Woo! You're the first video guy, man. Everybody's got a lot to live up to now, I tell you what.
Yeah, it's setting the bar high.
That's it. That's what you got to do. That's what you got to. We lead with naivete and set the bar high. This title's getting better and better for your memoir.
And we have closure.
Yes. And scene. Thank you very much,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, man. We'll see you soon.
I hope to see you soon.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Same thing.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, doggies. Was that fun or what? Nick Lane, ladies and gentlemen, one of the good guys, one of the great ones right there. And you know, every time trombone players get together, it's a righteous hang, an angel gets its wings, all good things happen. So once again, a great time was had by all. And that's it for this episode of Wiest World, and we'll be back next time, and it will be video once again, so spread the word. And in the meantime, be safe. I love you madly, as Duke Ellington used to say. And we'll see you again next time on Wiest World. Bye.
WCBC Wiest World.
Wiest World's production of Wiest World Productions 2025.
Man, that was... You're supposed to be talking fast. That was lame.